Merci à Collège de France et à professeur Chai de m'offrir cette chance de partager avec vous ma recherche sur Marie Curie. D'abord, je veux commencer par m'excuser de ne pas être capable de donner cette conférence entièrement en français. J'aimerais bien le faire, mais je sais aussi que la granularité de mon anglais est bien meilleure que celui de mon français. Alors, pour vous sauver d'une expérience traumatisante, ce matin, je parlerai en anglais. What is, and I should say, I've timed this for 45 minutes. I might go on a bit longer, but hopefully not too long. What is the first thing that comes to mind? A few days ago, I showed this image to my middle daughter, who is a photography undergraduate at Middlesex University in London. And while we might instantly recognize the woman, and perhaps even the context in which this image prefigures, that is the Marie Curie Actions Research Program of the EU, she answered exactly as I had thought she would, Warhol. So it wasn't Marie Curie, it wasn't excellence in science that popped into my daughter's mind, but the familiar iconography of Marilyn Monroe, Jacqueline Kennedy, Elizabeth Taylor, and Ingrid Bergman, only four of the many female celebrities that Andy Warhol colorized into fame. I'm not sure what the European Union thought about when they commissioned the image for the Marie Curie Actions Research Program. Maybe they were inspired by the Warholian palette, maybe they instinctively felt that Curie too today is the kind of celebrity that can match these four women. In 2009, L'Oréal commissioned a poll from The New Scientist to answer the question, who's the most inspirational female scientist? An unlikely survey for a cosmetic giant, perhaps, if not for the fact that it was sponsored by the L'Oréal UNESCO for Women in Science program, founded in 1998 on the premise that the world needs science and science needs women. Basically demolishing the competition, it was no great surprise that Marie Curie came out victorious, beating the British biophysicist Rosalind Franklin in second place with almost twice as many votes and placing Hypatia in a very distant third place. Curie remains, alongside this man, of course, Albert Einstein, the most instantly recognizable face of modern science. In terms of celebrity status, they are definitely in a league of their own. Having first met in 1909, they were on friendly terms, professionally and privately. He had sent her a kind and supportive letter at the time of the Langevin affair in 1911, and in 1913, they even vacationed together 2 weeks with their families in the Swiss Alps. Most significantly, however, they were both members of the League of Nations Commission Internationale de Coopération Intellectuelle, where they and 10 more eminent scholars, diplomats, and scientists would serve in an advisory capacity to the League's Assembly and Council in all matters relating to intellectual cooperation, a topic that was given the highest priority after the Great War. In Einstein, Curie saw an ally when it came to science and international collaboration, but he was probably also the only one whose fame was on par with her own at the time, and who knew exactly what she meant when she warily asked him in a letter dated January 6, 1924, "Don't you sometimes think that it is exasperating not being able to make a gesture without having it take on global significance?" One experience they shared was having close ties with Dollaria, which was Einstein's name for the United States at the time Curie made her second trip over there in 1929. But if the American press was smitten with Einstein, they were disappointed with Curie. Whereas Einstein showered witticism around him, played the violin, and seemed like a generally nice bloke, Curie had been tired and withdrawn during her trip, her brain fagged by the small talk of Americans, as the New York Times wrote with barely concealed irony on the eve of her departure following her six-week US tour in 1921, which I'll talk about next week. She was very admired, but her sternness, black dresses, and haggard looks did not sit well in a country where celebrity culture depended on celebrities actually willing to play along. Curie's claim to fame rests in part on being the only woman and only among a handful of laureates in total, twice awarded the Nobel Prize in 1903 and 1911. So children read about her in school, learning just how far perseverance and commitment can take you, even if you're a girl, or perhaps especially if you're a girl. Countless adolescents who dream about a life in science look up to her as a role model. Her own scientific life continues to fascinate and supply a steady demand for new biographies. There is not a textbook, a dictionary, or exhaustive encyclopedia of 20th century science that would be considered complete without her in it. Indeed, her fame is such that in 2005, the television audience of France 2 even ranked Curie fourth on the list of the 10 plus grands Français de tout le temps, trailing de Gaulle, Pasteur, and l'Abbé Pierre, but preceding comedian Coluche. So, posterity has actually mythologized these two French scientists on that France 2 list in analogous ways. Both have been the objects of successful biographies authored by close relatives, her daughter, his son-in-law, who wrote the book, if I'm correct, while Pasteur was still alive. Both were immortalized by Hollywood, Pasteur by Paul Muni in the Oscar-awarded The Story of Louis Pasteur from 1936, Marie Curie, of course, by Greer Garson in the 1943 MGM production of Madame Curie. And of course, there are the ubiquitous street names, parks, schools, squares, and other public places named after the two scientists. Yet, Curie has not been pasteurized. And this is certainly not a flippant joke. I'm not being coy, and I certainly do not intend any disrespect. But the fact remains that if we think of pasteurization not as the groundbreaking process of heating a food, which is usually a liquid, to a specific temperature for a predefined length of time and then immediately cooling it after it is removed from the heat, which is the current Wikipedia definition of pasteurization, but as a process of interpretation that situates a particular agent as a node in a network, as someone who is both powerful enough to act but also powerful enough to be acted upon, then I would maintain that there are few signs of a curification along the lines of a pasteurization that has situated Pasteur and his discoveries within larger networks of objects, people, and institutions. So Pasteur, Guerre et Paix des Microbes, is of course an evocative title, but the pasteurization of France is a brilliant title. In both cases, of course, Bruno Latour's book is a wonderful read and a very illuminating exercise in how to tell a story of science in which a person has been both privileged and erased, if you will, at the same time, dominating thus from a distance. Let me try and qualify this claim a bit better. It would seem as if, in contrast to Pasteur, or for that matter someone like Darwin, who's generated tons of books, Curie resists abstraction. Exploring, even embracing, Pasteur's individuality and personality poses no real threat to a critical investigation using the man to get at the world or the world to get at the man, simply because a male scientist can always function as a catalyst to address general observations about science. Thus, he fits even if he would be a misfit. Curie, on the other hand, circulates in a very closed loop reserved for a specific historical actor whose experience as a woman is so unique that it cannot be abstracted or generalized. As a result, Marie Curie tends to implode on herself, and the only thing she can tell us is the story about her, period. Compared to an umbrella-toting Mary Poppins, referred to as the Edith Piaf of radioactivity, even likened to Victor Hugo's Cosette, Curie may be malleable enough to be anyone, real or fictitious, as long as she remains this extraordinary outsider. Perhaps Curie is simply not brilliant enough to withstand a Pasteurian exercise. There are certainly hints here and there that her contributions to science was not up to par with her contemporaries Frederick Soddy and Ernest Rutherford. And according to... That was a nice break. I think I'll put it here. According to one of her biographies, Laurent Lemire, We have an Anglo-Saxon conspiracy fueled by cultural incomprehension and competition to blame for such depreciation. Be that as it may, the productiveness of the pasteurization perspective hardly hinges on the tricky judgment call of real genius, but rather on how many circles you can make in the water, if you see what I mean. And she made a ton, she made lots of circles in the water. Yet, despite excellent biographies from Susan Quinn and Robert Reed, innovative books such as Laurent Redney's fairly recent Radioactive, A Tale of Love and Fallout, and important works of Soraya Boudia, Xavier Roquet, Dominique Pestre, Bernadette Benson-Vincent, among others, Curie still comes to us as a remarkably one-dimensional person, suffering perhaps from being stuck in what Roquet calls the twilight zone of what Roquet calls the dismissive and the hagiographic. So despite all these fine contributions, a treatment of the Pasteurian kind has not quite occurred, at least not if we think of it as a Pasteurian perspective in the kind that Latour develops here. And Curie remains strangely disconnected, distant, placed, I think, very much still on a pedestal. But it's not through osmosis, nor through some law of nature, that Marie Curie continues to have a hold on our imagination. It's because she is continuously made and remade. She is, as in the Four Square Marie Curie Actions program, called upon to epitomize pure science and excellence in science. She's now a paper doll, a digital paper doll, on the Star Doll website, where you can dress her in, of course, the expected dark, muted colors. There's this wonderful spoof on the tabloid The Sun from the Langevin affair. It's dated December 11th, 1911. I showed it to my husband. He actually thought it was genuine to begin with. But if you look closer, you will see bylines such as in the, you know, down to the right, the byline is by someone called Radiation. That's the author, Radiation. And there are headings like You Glow Girl, etc. And of course, the ultimate proof. I mean, the ultimate proof that you've become part of popular culture, of course, is being featured on an episode of The Simpsons, even if it's only as evil destroyers of a city together with her husband. You have this kind of ominous imagery that have to do with ice and light and radiation, of course, on the cover of this comic, for instance. There's a wonderful, wonderful lots of images that you can find surrounding Marie Curie if you look closer. So the two talks I'm giving here at the Collège are both then connected to my ongoing work on a book which is preliminarily entitled Making Marie Curie, Intellectual Property, Celebrity Culture and the Power of Print. It's a bit long, you know, the second leg of the title will perhaps have to change. It's a project funded by HERA. I'm not sure if you know HERA, but HERA is the Humanities in the European Research Area, where I'm working in a larger consortium on copyright and cultural heritage, which runs from 2010 to 2013. So I'm just in the final stages of finalizing the manuscript on this book. And I have an advanced contract with the University of Chicago Press, so I'm sending in the manuscript to the publisher on September 1st. So I still have a few months trying to do the final stuff. So I'll spend the whole summer here in Paris, for instance, finalizing my work in the Curie archives. I'm not making any claims at all of having worked with or trying to discover the real Curie behind this jungle of representational bounty. In fact, it would be more correct to say that the representational bounty is what I'm interested in. My ambition is to write about how Marie Curie became Marie Curie, the making of Marie Curie, and to uncover something of the work that for more than a century has gone into, and of course continues to go into, creating the persona Marie Curie. And to do so means recognizing that the abundance of polls, encyclopedias, top 10 lists, EU research programs, and Simpson episodes are as relevant to this ongoing cultural construction of Curie as any biographical fact. I'll just very briefly give a broad sweep over the book and try to say something more generally about how I tried then to approach Curie's iconic status from three perspectives that sort of underpin the narrative as a whole. In the first chapter, in the interest of disinterestness, there's a chronological structure to the book. I consider the discovery and isolation of radium, and I focus on the production, on Curie's herself, production of the crucial notion of disinterestness, and how the Curie's belief in science for science's own sake related to questions of priority, collaboration, patenting, and publishing, and so on. The second chapter, Scandal, Slander, and Science, Surviving 1911, circulates, of course, around the year 1911, with a failed candidacy to the Académie des Sciences in the beginning of the year, and the five duels that were fought over her as a consequence of the so-called Langevin affair at the end. This was Marie Curie's own annus horribilis, despite the second Nobel that she was awarded that year in December. But it's also very much a story about the French mass press and its ongoing romance with science and scientists, if you will. I put into green here Curie's first trip to the United States in 1921, which is at the center of the third chapter. And the purpose, as you might know, was to receive 1 gram of radium given to her by the Women of America, who by popular subscription had collected $100,000 for its purchase. And as a quick comparison, if I'm correct, if I've looked at the exchange rates or correctly, this is the equivalent to having a crowdsourcing campaign today collect the equivalent of the 2012 Nobel Prize money and then give it to a worthy but struggling scientist somewhere. So it was a huge thing. Not only was the American tour of 1921 a marketing and publicity marvel on its own, it also set in motion and coincided with an intensification of Curie's own production of text commodities. I think the fact that she was a very successful author is a perspective of that hasn't been explored as much as it should be. The economy of the gift and the economy of print then were inextricably linked in the tour and the gift. And it was one person in particular who saw to it that these two came together as a seamless whole, and that was the editor and journalist Missy Brown Maloney. And despite the fact that both these tours have been written about in almost all biographies and other books as well, very little has been made on the wonderful and extensive correspondence between Curie and Missy Brown Maloney in the Curie archives. And I think it opens up a new window into Curie's research. Latour speaks of the Pasteurians, and there's no doubt that there were Curieans as well. Missy Brown Maloney is perhaps one of the most important of these, but because they're more than a decade-long friendship, looks nothing like what we have been taught research alliances and funding networks look like, we have simply not considered just how hard the Curist Missy Brown Maloney labored and how important she was in enabling Curie's research. And this is what I'll talk about next week. The focal point of the fourth and final chapter concerns Curie's work on la propriété scientifique in the Commission Internationale de Coopération Intellectuelle. Now, the fact that this ardent defender of disinterested science would, during the last decade of her life, become involved with the question of scientific property and the droit de savant, going so far as to even align herself with protection of ideas and not merely the application of the idea, is a fascinating story about the failed movement for a new legal regime that departed radically from existing practices in both science and intellectual property law at the time. So I'm not at all tempting the pasteurization of Curie, if you will, but I found it very interesting to think along the lines Latour suggested in his book on Pasteur. Of course, there's a biographical dimension to the book I'm working on, but if you're expecting a traditional cradle-to-grave biography of Marie Curie, this is not it. So there is a chronological ordering of the chapters, and they follow then, in sense, a very strict or a very old generic convention producing one of the principal narrative modes in the history of science. But what I've done is that I've picked certain events that have been important to me in trying to look at the making of Marie Curie. There's no doubt that other choices could have been made. This is an enormously rich material on Curie, and as you embark on one investigative path, the forks in the road sort of multiply exponentially. I know now that I have lots of material that I'm sort of putting into one document and keeping for a later time when they might generate articles or whatever. But you always have to make choices when writing a book, and some things won't go in here. Some things will, you know, could have gone in here, but are not going in here. One such example that I find, I'll mention very briefly, but I find quite interesting and I would like to work with a bit, is Curie's afterlife as a brand, where she has increasingly come then to exemplify what European excellence in science is or should be all about. Not in small part through the active management of the European Union and its paraphernalia of programs bearing her name. And I'd like to call attention to the kind of language used in the promotion of these grants from the website. Not only is it MCA on Facebook, but it says, since the 1st of February, the Marie Curie Actions will be on Facebook to get across with young researchers and students and to further spread out, which is sounds like a very strange English, and to further spread out the Marie Curie brand. So I think this is quite an interesting, it's not the Marie Curie program or the Marie Curie Actions brand, it's the Marie Curie brand. So I'm very interested in how Marie Curie has turned into an intellectual property function, if you will, by using this kind of language. What does it mean? My narrative too, of course, adds another layer to this myth, and it does so by revolving around three interrelated motifs that I've combined differently and with varying emphasis in each chapter, but that all three sort of run together as a backdrop throughout the book. And the result of having picked these is, of course, mirrors your own sort of research trajectory and topics that I've worked on and that I find interesting. I've mapped this way ahead through Curie because it's, you know, a persona print property, because it's here that my own research interests in a way converge. And the first of these then, persona, concentrates on the emergence of the Curie persona, which then can be defined as the culturally produced trace or copy of the person. And actually, Latour operates along the same line with Pasteur, where he distinguishes between the person Pasteur and Pasteur the persona by putting brackets around the second, which is a simple but very effective way of making the difference between them clear. Now, this is an undertaking that automatically takes us into the domain of fame and celebrity, a sphere which we traditionally associate with the ups and downs of Hollywood actors, sports stars, and politicians. More recently, being a participant in an endless line of interchangeable television reality shows such as Big Brother or The Bachelorette has put a new spin on the dictum famous for being famous. It's a category scientists very rarely find themselves in. However, as a list regular on the Forbes annual tally of top earning dead celebrities, Albert Einstein is a notable exception to the rule. Now, this is the 2012 list, but in 2011, he landed as number 7 out of 15 famous deceased who continue to make money from beyond the grave. Far beyond the top-grossing Michael Jackson and Elvis Presley, in 2012 it was Elizabeth Taylor, because you know, her estate was sold off, and lots of jewelry and stuff that garnered lots of money. Einstein still pulled in a respectable $10 million to the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, which is the owner of his intellectual property. And there are far more Einstein mugs than there are Curie ties. And Curie is not on the Forbes list and cannot match Einstein when it comes to the paraphernalia or merchandising generated by the latter. She was a celebrity practically from the day she and Pierre Curie discovered radium, and definitely from the time that they received the Nobel Prize for that work in 1903. Now, this famous Vanity Fair caricature from 1904 can perhaps serve as an example illustrating the Curie's relationship with the press. While the intensive media coverage following the 1903 Nobel represented an irritating disturbance into the Curie's work they would have probably preferred to continue in anonymity, Print was also the foremost vehicle by which their priority and importance could be affirmed and continuously upheld. By the beginning of 1904, the Parisian press had made radium and radioactivity salon buzzwords, and the Curies were the talk of the town. 2 years later, Pierre Curie's tragic but spectacularly newsworthy death changed everything. Not only did it mark the end of the we of an internationally recognized scientific partnership that had become the pride of the French nation, even more importantly, gone was the celebrity couple that since 1903 had become sought after prey for the press. As long as Pierre Curie was alive, Marie Curie was the irrepressible sidekick, a collaboration curiosity where there was never any real question or any real doubt about who led and who followed. Rightly or wrongly, he was the trailblazing innovator of radium. She was the enabler, the shoulder of support, the capable assistant. Widowhood meant that new lines had to be drawn between Marie Curie and the press, and these borders demarcated an unknown territory. There were familiar enough images and words to describe him, but someone like her had not really existed before. So Marie Curie sans Pierre was a clean slate. Now, the best evidence of just how far Curie's celebrity extended at the time of her failed candidacy to the Académie in 1911 comes from the bimonthly magazine Féminin. Launched in 1901, Féminin was almost entirely devoted to a modern urban readership, and its editorial policy rested on a combination of news, gossip, and human interest stories, with an emphasis on so-called stereotype-breaking pursuits. Few women were as stereotype-breaking as Curie, and few periods in her life had proved it so conclusively as her 1911 candidacy to the Académie. The stakes had never been so high, the investment never so hard-earned, and the failure never so humiliatingly public. And Féminin covered it all. And I'm sorry that the quality of this image is not very good, but you might be able to make out that Le photographe est sans pitié, which it says on the top of the... And what it shows is that Curie hounded by paparazzis outside her laboratory, trying to shield herself from the cameras with her bags. And the text then referred to the recent controversies over her candidacy and noted that she was involuntarily and despite herself a person in the news. Journalists and photographers relentlessly assault her home and laboratory. And while Féminin coyly took pains to disassociate themselves from this particular photographer, claiming that he was not on their payroll, they did not want to withhold readers the fascinating snapshots taken outside the door of a Rue Cuvier laboratory. Fascinating snapshots taken by merciless photographers and revealing much of the same kind of invasive presence that we associate with present-day celebrity hunting. So we have photo flashes rather than radium fluorescence sort of lighting up Marie Curie. By early spring 1911, Marie Curie was more of a celebrity than ever, largely due then to mediating influences of magazines such as Féminin. This time, however, she was not the co-discoverer, collaborator, or co-anything, but candidate to a powerful academic institution alone. There have, of course, been notorious precursors, celebrity precursors in French society, Georges Sand in her time, and of course, larger than life, Sarah Bernhardt, whose celebrity status far eclipsed that of Curie's. But eccentrics like Sarah Bernhardt were accepted, embraced, and even beloved as eccentrics, a status that conferred a kind of hyper-individuality outside normal rules of accountability. This was not Curie's kind of celebrity. The widow of Pierre Curie, the mother of two, the physicist, embodied the kind of womanhood sanctioned and admired by Féminin and its readers. Her black dresses and grave demeanor epitomized the celebrity of ordinariness, not the radical individualism displayed by Sarah Bernhardt. Marie Curie was different, but as she was about to learn in November 1911, the hard way, she was not different enough to avoid being held accountable for her actions. Cheryl Hamilton has written, I think, very, very well on celebrity and persona and personhood, and said that a celebrity crystallizes when we both desire and recognize a relationship between a person and a persona. And I think this is very much what happens with Curie. during her during these years that I've just discussed. At first blush, science and celebrity culture appear to have little or nothing in common. But if we look a little closer, we can see that no matter how invested you might be in trying to keep them on their separate tracks, they both shared and continue to share a dependency on print culture. Now, because my background is in comparative literature and in book history, I feel quite at home focusing on texts or books, if you will. And so in the second motif, I try to use or try to look at how laboratory notebooks, articles, papers, patents, contemporary legal doctrine, advertising, penny press clippings, and popular science articles sort of work together to create this hybrid terrain of material and textual conditions that made Curie's persona possible, or that underpinned the development of the persona. We have, of course, an endless row of books for children and juveniles, for instance, that have schooled us into science and that remain powerful sites for the reproduction of the Curie persona. For instance, the Kindle version in the series of Giants of Science, as you see to the left, is a typical example of the way in which we frame science or scientific discoveries in children's and juvenile books. And of course, this has been done, but I think as a parenthesis, that studying the construction of science through juvenile books seems to me a very interesting and rewarding undertaking, because clearly this is the way that we're schooled into knowing what science is all about. But nobody was as good as making Marie Curie as Marie Curie. And much of what we know about Marie Curie, we know because it's been filtered down to us through carefully orchestrated narratives by the dramatis persona themselves. And this book, I think, is probably one of the most important access points into the Curie myth or the Curie legacy, and that's Marie Curie's biography of Pierre Curie from 1923 and 1924. And as you can see, in the French edition, the author is Madame Curie. In the American edition, it's Marie Curie. And there's also an introduction by Mrs. William Brown Maloney and autobiographical notes by Marie Curie. And of course, these autobiographical notes were only written for the American edition. There's nothing like that in the French edition. And I might be wrong, but I did a first, and it sounds really implausible, but I did a search in the BNF catalog and I couldn't find a copy of the American edition of Pierre Curie in the BNF. I'm sure I'm wrong, I'll have to do another search. Anyway, it was first published in the US in 1923, and then it was published by Peyot in 1924, although she had signed the contract with Peyot already in 1920, if I'm not mistaken. These are very interesting texts, I think, on understanding. And Madame Curie, of course, Eve Curie's famous hagiography of her mother from 1938, which was serialized in the Saturday Evening Post in 1937. You can see the first cover, the life story of Madame Curie there. But there's also a fascinating interpretation by Irène Joliot-Curie of her parents' laboratory notebooks published in the 1955 edition of Pierre Curie. We have collections of correspondence between Marie Curie and her daughters. It's actually hard to overestimate just how influential the unparalleled micromanagement by the Curies themselves, in a sense, have been in creating the Curie persona. And it's a very interesting textual trail, I think, that one could follow here. The third and last motif I'm working with is property then, and especially, of course, intellectual property. And it's arguably because this is the work I've been doing for more than a decade is on intellectual property, especially copyright, although I've become much more interested in patents during the last few years. But it's also the most unexpected. To be able to hold property is part of what it means to be recognized as a person. We can probably agree on that. Intellectual property, especially, which is dependent on concepts such as authority, authorship, and ownership, hinge very much on the articulation of personality and persona. While I work with patents, trademark, and copyright material throughout the book, it's important to underscore as much as they engender separate legal regimes with their own histories, rationales, materialities, and of course national histories as well. There's no international copyright. These are national laws. They are still related. Patents focus on science and innovation, trademarks on information, and copyright, of course, mainly on cultural expressions. We can think of these three as triangulating, if you will, a formal set of regulations of knowledge systems. But having said that, intellectual property rights are not the only means by which regulation is achieved. And their current status should not blind us from recognizing the importance of other informal modes of control. So I've been particularly interested in understanding how the development of the Curie persona relates to formal as well as informal claims of intellectual property, and what role print culture then served in underwriting such a purpose. But why this particular choice of focus? Why indeed, considering the well-known fact that the Curies never patented radium or the processes of radium extraction? In effect, they were known as ardent defenders of pure science, always endorsing the notion of disinterestedness and values that we today have come to associate with the open science movement. When Marie Curie agreed to write the biography of her late husband, she was also given an opportunity to make one of the few openly programmatic statements about how the famous husband and wife team viewed their work. And 20 years after the fact, she did the most of it. And this is a quote from the American edition. The French looks pretty much the same. It's not that big of a difference. But what she writes here is that a programmatic statement that is repeated and repeated again in various contexts. Our investigations had started a general scientific movement, and similar work was being undertaken in other countries. Towards these efforts, Pierre Curie maintained a most disinterested and liberal attitude. With my agreement, he refused to draw any material profit from our discovery. We took no copyright and published without reserve all of the results of our research, as well as the exact processes of the preparation of radium. In addition, we gave to those interested whatever information they asked of us. This was of great benefit to the radium industry, which could thus develop in full freedom, first in France, then in foreign countries, and furnish to scientists and to physicians the products which they needed. This industry still employs today, with scarcely any modifications, the processes indicated by us. Now, as she enumerated the do's and the don'ts, Curie situated scientific practice within a gift market dichotomy, upholding two distinct systems of credit and reward. Intellectual property represented an interested perspective, where you reserve advantage, choosing to publish without reserve and keeping no detailed secret, instead epitomized the values of disinterestedness. Abstaining from proprietary shackles on radium spurned more innovative activity in both science and industry, and not less. The industry could then develop in full freedom, first in France, then in foreign countries. Now, this is as close as we get to a will and testament about the discovery of radium and the science of radioactivity, nailing down the leitmotif of the Curie scientific legacy. Yes, material profit was refused, but on the other hand, publishing took place without reserve. No advantage was reserved in industrial application, but no detail was kept secret and information given freely. Now, diligent readers might find the expression "took out no copyright" slightly odd given the circumstances. And it's also correct that the original French text refers to the more logical brevet. And what was the result of their action of non-action? It was not the opening up of science new great unknown, but the blossoming of a radium industry. And all of this because of subscribing to the value of disinterestedness. Yet, if you scratch the surface, the altruistic surface, you find a remarkably strong claim to radium. Everything in the science and industry of radium begins and ends with the Curies. They are the privileged node in an expanding radium network, the initiators, the parents, the authors, the authorities, the uncontested authorities on radium. So taking this quote as my point of departure for the book, the first chapter begins in essence with this book, this quote. I'm trying to understand more of how this powerful representational dichotomy between publishing and patenting came about as it did in Pierre Curie. So I'm hoping to show that Marie Curie's rhetorical technique resulted from a set of claiming strategies that joined quite diverse texts together with the ultimate goal of securing a kind of control over radium that was outside formal intellectual property regimes. In any case, there was a lot of interest that went into disinterestness, if you will. And in fact, this book came about because of my interest in the increasingly contentious role of intellectual property rights in late modern society, and especially its formative influence on science. Having worked for now more than 12 years on the cultural industries and copyright and the commons, I have become increasingly interested in the way in which research and science relates to intellectual property. So this book is, in a sense, a response to another direction in my own research. So I was very much intrigued first by the Curie's negation of patenting, which is hardly a revolutionary stance at the time, but still, because it seemed refreshingly out of sync with what we encounter today. So in a sense, I was trying to begin this project as an answer to a very nice formulation by Stephen Chapin, and of course it's poor form, letting somebody else speak for you. But he has written in this Scientific Life that it's inevitable that we write about the past as an expression of present concerns, and we can write about the past to find out about how it came to be that we live as we do now, and indeed for giving better descriptions of the way we live now. So my Curie project, in a sense, started as a response to this, if you will. It was only later into my work that I realized that theirs, and especially hers, was a much more complex relationship with intellectual property than I had anticipated. But as so often is the case then, the gray turned out much more interesting than the black and white. Because in all its guises, the laboratory was also a legal space, was one where bodies, laws, and texts clashed and overlapped. And as an illustration of how the discovery of radium and the Curie's claims to it, as articulated in Pierre Curie, for instance, had something to do with the law, I'm trying to work with the Code Civil, of course, and the 1844 Loi sur les brevets d'invention as a backdrop for this chapter or for the arguments I'm trying to make. Because the Code Civil, obviously, had set up a detailed, famously patriarchal system that governed the perimeters and rationales, conduct and the breaches of conduct relating to family life. But the 1844 Loi sur les brevets d'invention, of course, tried to capture a different kind of relations, one which placed itself in the spheres of innovation and progress as public and professional, separated then from family life and domestic nitty-gritty. So what I'm trying to do is that I'm trying to look at the laboratory as a space where these two, in a sense, come together because Marie Curie is a woman and because Pierre Curie is a man. So I'm trying to situate the laboratory as a permeable continuum between pure and applied, between interest and disinterestness, between gift and market, but also between the Code Civil's Le Petit Monde and Le Grand Monde suggested by the Loi sur les brevets d'invention. What happened in the laboratory could not stay in the laboratory. We have a married couple measuring, scribbling, and weighing their way into print. And it was the textual evidence coming out of the shared interest, the way she put it, the shared interest in all sorts of things, transferred into various forums and translated into various formats that made both scientists famous, recognized, and published. But during the period Marie Curie became famous, recognized, and published, she had few legal entitlements and was unable to sign a contract or exercise control over her own grants. So during the period when she becomes this public figure that we recognize and think we know so well, at the time her presence and power in the public sphere begins, she was in a sense a half citizen. So if we, in case we need reminding about this, the interstitials of science, innovation, and intellectual property are historically contingent, they're not historically given. And I think it would be unwise not to expect her strategies vis-a-vis radium not to develop in a certain direction because of this. We can't ignore it in any way. So tentatively, one might say that if Curie was not a person under the law during her marriage with Pierre Curie and thus unable to hold property, as a persona, she could still control and exercise a form of power over radium. And this is something that I'm trying to sort of understand and see if it's possible to make that argument. Paul Lucier has written a very good article on patenting science in the 19th century, and there he says that any scientist, he talks, and you can apply this, of course, to the kind of dilemma that the Curies faced. Any scientist who patented research put at risk his professional integrity. Still, if a scientist wanted to protect his rights as a discoverer, he would have to patent. And of course, there's nothing odd in having a he here, but it's worth reminding, thinking about the fact that it is extremely gendered, this kind of, you know, relationship to the law, and to which I think is sort of often forgotten in this case. So the Marie Curie I've worked on for the past 3 years seems to me to be quite driven, very concerned with the heritage and control of radium, exceedingly good at getting people to work for her, something that I'll talk about more than next week when I'll talk about what Missy Brown Maloney actually managed to do. But could her achievement be any less impressive, any less important if she was to become a bit more pasteurized? I don't think so. On the contrary. So I'm trying to resist a kind of diminishing logic that I think has existed, that has tended to situate Curie as a woman first, a person only second, and a catalyst for any kind of generalizable observation on the conditions of modern science as a very distant third. Given her personal trajectory and her impact today, I feel convinced that exploring, or I hope so, that exploring this kind of interstitches between persona, print, property is a way of saying something about the strategies that are needed to claim discovery, invention, authorship, and ownership, and how they take place both inside and outside the intellectual property system proper. So to arrive at an understanding of where she is today, if I can do that, I try then to trace this career for 40 years, two centuries, one world war, the arrival of celebrity culture, and the transformation of scientific knowledge, as well as the way in which its rationales, functions, and its institutional makeup. And doing so will hopefully provide not only a composite picture of the making of Marie Curie, but in however smaller measure also of the making of modern science. Thank you.